headlines, the new U.S. administration says that it will review the peace agreement Washington reached with the Taliban last year. Dozens of U.S. National Guard troops deployed to secure the presidential inauguration are tested positive with coronavirus. Iraqi security sources say the Baghdad International Airport has come under rocket attack, with no casualties being reported. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mies. Thanks for joining us. The new U.S. administration says that it will review the peace agreement Washington reached with the Taliban last year. President Joe Biden's national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, informed his Afghan counterpart, Hamdullah Mohib, about the review in a phone call. Sullivan told him that the U.S. wants to check whether the militant group is living up to its commitments to reduce violence. He said that the U.S. will support the peace process for a permanent ceasefire. Under the deal between the U.S. and the Taliban, all American forces will leave the country by May. The Taliban have pledged not to engage in violence. The group, however, continues attacks, including on government forces. Correspondent in Kabul, Amin Alami, says the Taliban expects that the Biden administration will support the Afghan peace deal.
Afghanistan's Interior Ministry and Afghanistan's Defense Ministry have released separate statements regarding to the rising Taliban attacks, bombings, and mainly targeted killings across Afghanistan, especially over the last 3 months. This comes while top military and political officials here in Kabul have repeatedly blamed the Taliban militant group for not being honest regarding to bringing peace and stability in this country, as the latest reports from Qatari capital Doha suggest. Both negotiating teams of the Afghan government and the Taliban militant group have not sat together since last week. The Afghan government representatives there in Qatar say that the main cause is that the Taliban are making excuses on the way of intra-Afghan talks. However, it seems that the Taliban is also waiting for the decisions or plans that are expected to be declared by the new U.S. President Joe Biden. They also expect that the new U.S. administration approve and even strongly support the U.S. Taliban deal that paves the way for the withdrawal of all U.S. forces from Afghanistan.
Dozens of U.S. National Guard troops deployed to Washington, D.C. for the inauguration of President Joe Biden have tested positive with the coronavirus. The U.S. officials spoke to the media on the condition of anonymity that the number of infected guards is between 150 and 200, which is set to likely to rise. Earlier, the stationing of some of the guard members in a garage near the Capitol building sparked outrage among politicians. Biden and a group of lawmakers apologized for the move. D.C. authorities took unprecedented security measures ahead of the presidential inauguration, deploying more than 25,000 troops to the city. That's after supporters of former President Donald Trump stormed the Congress building on January 6th in their bid to overturn the November election results. The new U.S. president has signed an executive order for a relief package to address what he called the nation's worst economic crisis in modern history.
We remain in a once-in-a-century public health crisis that's led to the most unequal job and economic crisis in modern history. This is an economic imperative, a growing economic consensus that we must act decisively and boldly to grow the economy for all Americans, not just for tomorrow, but in the future.
Joe Biden called the current economic and health situation a national emergency. Biden said one in seven Americans is now struggling to eat due to the COVID-19 pandemic as jobless numbers mount. He noted that the situation is even worse for Latinos and African Americans. Biden also warned that COVID-19 is expected to kill well over 600,000 people in the U.S. The virus has so far infected over 24 million Americans, killing more than 410,000 others. Early economic analyst David Barkin joined us with his take on Biden's labeling of the current economic and health situations in the U.S. as a national emergency.
I think that the national emergency has been there for quite a while. The big difference is that Biden is identifying it, he's putting a name on it, because he's looking at the way in which the economy has affected socially and the American people, and the way it has driven a wedge between the most affluent of the U.S. population and the vast majority of working people, and especially minorities, who have been left out of the economic dynamics for quite some time. Although people in the past, in the recent past, have talked about a full an employment economy, the problem is that the wages, the incomes of a great majority of even employed people in the United States are insufficient to allow them to put food on their plates and pay their rent.
The United States, Mexico, and Guatemala have agreed to bar migrant caravans from passing through their territories due to the COVID-19 pandemic. U.S. Ambassador to Guatemala, William Popp, stressed that any migrants who cross the U.S. border in an irregular manner will be returned home immediately, citing national health security. His comments came after a meeting with the Guatemalan Foreign Minister, Pedro Brolo, and the Mexican Ambassador to Guatemala, Romeo Ruiz. The deal came after Guatemalan authorities on Monday broke up the latest caravan of Honduran migrants. Officers used tear gas and batons to break up the caravan. The migrants did not have required travel documents or proof of negative COVID tests. Clashes have broken out between demonstrators and police during the anti-government protests in Chile's capital, Santiago. Police and riot gear used tear gas and water cannon to disperse the demonstrators. Several protesters were taken into custody, but the exact number of those arrested is not known. Protests in Chile began over a year ago, calling for reforms to the pension, healthcare, and education systems. Every Friday, protesters take to the streets to demonstrate against what they call inequality in one of Latin America's most developed countries. Time now for the news review of this bulletin. Hello, welcome to the news review. The U.S. State Department says it has started to review the terrorist designation of Yemen's Ansar Allah movement days after the inauguration of Joe Biden as the new U.S. president. The department said it is working as fast as possible to conduct the review and make a determination. That is while former U.S. President Donald Trump blacklisted Ansar Allah as a terrorist group in the final days of his administration. The move triggered protests from the U.N. and international aid groups as well as the Yemeni people. UN officials believe that the act would further complicate efforts to combat the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The UN fears that the designation will discourage foreign businesses from helping the war-torn nation. The humanitarian situation in the country has worsened due to years of Saudi-led war and blockade. Hussein Abu-Fiti is a Yemeni activist and political commentator joining us from Sana'a. We have Saad Shahabi, who's a political analyst and Middle East expert, joining us from London. Welcome to you both, Hussein Abu-Fiti. Your reaction to this piece of news?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. To be honest with you, I think this kind of statement is just for media consumption. I don't think that Joe Biden will, his government will remove Ansar Allah the Houthi from the so-called designated terrorist list. Neither will he stop the sales of weapons toward Saudi Arabia. Biden is, they are calling him or naming him in the United States as the shadow of Obama or Obama shadow. And this war has actually started during Obama administration, and the largest deals for weapon sales have been during as well Obama administration. That's why I don't think, because the United States foreign policy, security policy is one, despite the fact either is Trump as president or now Biden, and in the coming days, in the coming weeks, we will see that none of the promises that was made by Biden will be made, as example, to stop the war on Yemen, or at least to stop the sales of weapons to Saudi Arabia, and as well the case about the killing of the journalist Khashoggi. So in the coming weeks and days, we will see, because the blockade that's enforced on Yemen, the United States and Saudi Arabia, they are behind that blockade that have killed more than 300,000 Yemenis. Just imagine, if they are not allowing food and medicine to come to Yemen, they are not allowing fuel ship to enter Yemen, Hodeidah port, even though after they are searched by Saudi Arabia, United Nations and United States, I don't think that Biden actually will do anything towards Yemen either, to take Houthis from the labeling as terrorist group. But both ways, here in Sana'a, they believe that the war is, the United States is fully behind this war. So for them here in Sana'a, it will not matter if they stay on the list or not, because the war still continue and the blockade has not stopped from the beginning of this war.
Well, Sasha Habi, the news says that this new U.S. administration is going to review the terrorist labeling of the Nasrallah fighters. And that's due to humanitarian crisis that's happening, that it would complicate matters. If they are sincere, and if the U.S. President Joe Biden is sincere, why doesn't he say to Saudi Arabia, stop the war, stop bombing Yemen, and let humanitarian supplies get into the country while we review this terrorist designation? Because that's another obstacle, is when a war is going on, which is, the Saudi Arabia is leading in its air campaign, is stopping aid from being distributed. Just one example.
Thank you very much, and welcome to you and to our guest, our friend Hussein Rukhaiti. And of course, our salute goes to the people of Yemen who have been able to withstand all the crimes that have been committed by the Saudi Emirati Khalifi American invasion. Now, Yemen will remain the barometer of the Biden presidency. This is the first important, most important issue, I think, today, because there are more than 30 million lives at stake there. The worst humanitarian crisis in modern times. People are dying, children are dying, and so on and so forth. And this is all committed by the Saudis and the Emiratis, of course, supported by both the American and the British experts on the ground. Now, if Biden is not going to take serious action to stop the war, to remove Ansarullah from the list of terrorism, then I think probably the whole world will become angry and will become disappointed that they put a lot of expectations on this Democrat president. And if he doesn't do that, then what else should he start with? This is the most important issue. He should declare immediately, without any further delay, that the U.S. is withdrawing from Yemen, that it is stopping supplies of weapons to the Saudis and the Emiratis and Khalifis of Bahrain, and that it is going to remove Ansarullah or any hint of putting them on the list of terrorism, because the whole world, even Mr. Guterres himself, the United Nations Security General, as well as other aid groups, are saying that unless Ansarullah is removed from that list, then we will not be able to carry out our duties. Also, one final point, the U.S. said that they are not going to put any blockade or any boycott of the aid agencies that are working in Yemen, which is a reasonable thing to do. But the most important thing is to stop this aggression immediately and without any further delay.
Okay, and over to you, Hossein Abu Khaiti. One of the things that this terrorist designation, by the outgoing, at that point, U.S. President Donald Trump did, was it prevented any type of political process or reconciliation were to be in the works between the opposition and the current Yemeni government. And do you think that there is now an incentive for the Biden administration to undo this terrorist organization labeling, at least to get the political process going?
I mean, of course, they can do that. But from the first day when Trump has put Ansarullah in that list, I knew that United States and they have found as a scapegoat for Saudi Arabia not to continue talks here with the government in Sana'a, even though for the last several months there wasn't any meeting or any talk or the peace process. We have seen as well on the other hand that UN envoy to Yemen, Martin Griffiths, he has actually become like a postman between the mercenary themselves. He was going from Riyadh to Abu Dhabi to solve the problem and the issues between their mercenary fighting on the ground on Yemen, and he totally forgot that he is the UN envoy to Yemen. He's not the UN envoy between Saudi Arabia or between their mercenaries. So from the beginning, the peace process has actually stopped. But I think that if this will continue and if the Saudi Arabia will use this designation of the Houthis as terrorist group as an scapegoat not to stop the war and blockade in Yemen, I think that we might come to, here in Sana'a, they might come to a decision making will be taken by the military side here in Sana'a. And I think at that time, Saudi Arabia will regret the time that they have pressed on United States to designate the Houthis, because when we come to that day, we will see more attack against Saudi Arabia and against United Arab Emirates, because Yemeni and here Sana'a government will not stay silent without doing anything to lift the blockade, because they can do so. They can close the Strait of Bab al-Mandab. They can target Saudi Arabia oil infrastructure. They can knock it out, and as well the United Arab Emirates. But they still always given some time for the other side. Maybe they will change. But I think if this will continue as it is now, Sana'a government have the full responsibility to protect Yemenis. They have all the responsibility. If Saudi keep continuing killing Yemenis, either by blockade or Saudi airstrike, I don't think we should keep blaming Saudi Arabia and United States, because those are our enemy. So we should blame Sana'a for not stopping this, because Abdul Malik al-Houthi and as well the leaders here of Ansarullah and Sana'a government and military leaders have said that they can break Saudi Arabia, but they still wait. Maybe the peace process will go, but we have come to this point that this will not happen. That's why Sana'a should take strong decision to stop the killing and the blockade on Yemen.
Thank you very much for that, Hossein Abouqaiti, Yemeni activist and political commentator. Saad Shahabi, thank you. Political analyst and Middle East expert there from London. And that does it for the News Review. Thanks for tuning in. Iraqi security sources say the Baghdad International Airport has come under rocket attack with no report of casualties. Sources said three Katyusha rockets were fired toward the airport, with one hitting a residential building in the Jihad neighborhood, causing material damage. The Victory Base Complex, which is a U.S. military installation, is also located in the same area. No group has claimed responsibility. Areas around Baghdad Airport have come under similar attacks in the past. Last month, a rocket also targeted Baghdad's heavily fortified Green Zone that houses the U.S. Embassy. Recently, a series of attacks also targeted logistic vehicles of the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq. That's amid growing anti-American sentiments in the Arab country. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa by a shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. Aperture.
A visit to Iran yields a stunning variety of culinary delights. There's a vast spectrum of foods flourishing for centuries and evolving since Achaemenid times. Persian cooking incorporates many flavors into its uniquely delicious food traditions. A taste of Persia's food can be identified by its sumptuous rice dishes, its intriguing and delicate flavors, and its combination of herbs, spice, fruit, and nuts. And one integral component to Persian cuisine is the use of saffron, the world's most expensive spice, which gives Iranian food its distinct flavor and aroma and golden hue. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Many coveted ingredients are native to Iran, including pistachios, almonds, walnuts, pomegranates, grapes, and perhaps most notably, saffron. Iran has a variable climate with four distinct seasons. The ancient Persians transformed vast stretches of arid land into fertile oases through underground aquifers that drew melted snow water into the desert. And thus, a bright, sensuous fruit and herb-filled cuisine was born. This week on Aperture, we will follow Javad Gharayi as he explores the amazing deserts of South Khorasan province and visits a charming little village where saffron, the world's most highly prized spice, is grown. Don't miss the first part.
This time, I leave the cold winter weather in the capital city for the beautiful desert flower farms. My destination is the outskirts of South Khorasan province, an area famous for its saffron, Iran's prized red gold. Iran is one of the most mountainous countries in the world, covered by rugged mountain ranges and deserts. 61% of the country has a dry climate. Deserts cover a combined area of around 34 million hectares, scattered among 18 of its provinces. That means around 30% of the country is made up of vast deserts featuring many mountains, salt pans, and sand dunes. Deserts across the world share almost the same features. Little precipitation, intense evaporation of water due to the scorching sun, smothering heat, dry air, great temperature fluctuations, poor vegetation, and a dearth of adequate organic compounds in the soil. However, despite the hostile climate of the deserts of Iran, life is in progress on their margins. Hi, I'm Javad Gharayi. I'm an Iran trotter, and I'm taking you on a journey to the most pristine areas of my beloved country and showing you their many beauties. Before visiting the Saffron Grove, I decide to take a look around at the desert surroundings on the outskirts of South Khorasan province. To that end, I begin my journey with Halwan Desert, located within 90 kilometers of Tabas, a city in and the capital of Tabas County, in the northwest of South Khorasan. Because of its distance from the urban areas, the natural beauties of deserts are not known to humans as much as they should. If you want to venture out into the desert, in order to admire its matchless beauties, you'd have to choose the right season and the right time of day. From a distance, deserts and the wilderness don't seem all that beautiful. Once you've set foot in them, you feel as if you've stepped into a veritable heaven. But a different kind of heaven. You don't see forests with tall trees, grass, or running water. All you can see is streams with very salty water, single salt cedars and saxholes, scattered shrubs and bushes in the landscape, camels and other species unique to this hot and dry climate. It's very beautiful and peaceful here, but that's not always the case. Within minutes, this whole area can turn into an ominously stormy ocean. Ferocious storms of sand and dust that have buried many a caravan and traveler over the course of centuries. In the not-too-distant past, some of Iran's deserts were inhabited by people living in this climate. But thanks to global warming and decreased precipitation that led to drinking water wells drying and parts of the vegetation dying, the people living in such areas were forced to leave their little villages for a better place. Today, those villages lay in ruins on their original locations. Ruins that now serve as shelters for the camel herders against the blazing sun. But these homes of yesterday are still as beautiful as ever. Deserts around the world are expanding by the year. Desert expansion or desertification is a result of global warming, the growth in the human population, unplanned agriculture and excessive firewood collection, depletion of subterranean water resources, industrial contaminants and excessive use of fossil fuels, overgrazing by livestock, and the change in the use of agricultural land. This conversion of habitable and fertile land to uninhabitable desert can happen naturally due to a drought, or can be caused by human activities. Activities that have disturbed the balance of nature on planet Earth. Iran accounts for more than 2% of the world's drought. It's also home to more than 8% of the deserts and arid lands that contain no vegetation, and that is considered a big number. But in the fringes of this same hot and dry desert, meaning the one in South Khorasan, there are mountains that supply the rivers and qanats in this area with drinking water. Streams that could be regarded as the natural wonders of this otherwise parched region. Taht-e-Arus, or the Bride's Throne, near the village of Izmiran on the Tabas-Mashhad Road, is a befitting name for this stream, The flowing water reminds me of the celebrations held by people in the old times upon the discovery of clean, fresh water in a hot and dry region. Only those born and bred in a dry climate with limited resources of fresh water appreciate its true value. People who have endured thirst, have felt the baking heat from the sun on their skin, and may have seen rain coming down from the skies over their heads only once a year. The people of Esmiran fit that profile perfectly. God has bestowed upon them fresh water in a stream gushing out of the dry desert mountains around Tebas. And the people here have utmost appreciation for this most precious of God's blessings in the heart of the natural world. In the distant past, the people of Esmiran lived in dwellings carved into mountain wall. With the tools they had, they would dig deep vertical and horizontal holes into the side of the mountains. In them, they'd carve out rooms where they'd live. In the past, these hand-carved chambers were referred to as looms. Desert people are very smart. Using the water from the stream and the fertile soil here, they've been farming rice for generations. Today, the rice produced in Esmiran is among the best in the country. Who would believe there are paddy fields in the middle of a desert and among these mountains? Everybody thinks rice is only grown in the north of Iran. But where does the stream go on this dry land? After irrigating the paddy fields of Esmiran, does it sink into the arid terrain in the areas surrounding the rice farms? That can't be the case, because to the desert dwellers, fresh water is worth more than diamonds. The locals in this area have spoken to me of a formidable yet beautiful canyon and helped me see the rest of the course that the water from Tahtiaru Spring takes. The name of that canyon is Kala Jinni, the Canal of Jinns, shaped by water movement and erosion over centuries. I'm going to step into a canyon where the water from Tahtiaru Spring is flowing, but the volume of the water is not large enough to make it to the end of this very long course without going to waste. I'm curious to know how that water continues on its path in the dry land and where it eventually gets to. It's simply beautiful. As I said, the name of the awe-inspiring canyon is Kala Jinni. On its bottom, water from the Tahtiaru Spring of Tabaz is moving as we speak. Most of the way, the water flows between the two walls of this canyon, just like it does in Akhanat, and springs out of the underground near Tabaz. It's one of the most beautiful sights to see around the city of Tabaz in South Khorasan province, the Canal of Jinns. That's a scary name. Kala Jinni was shaped so beautifully by water movements, such as seasonal rain-induced floodwaters over thousands or millions of years. It kind of looks like the Grand Canyon in the U.S., though it doesn't share the same depth. It really is stunning. After a long walk in the mountains, I arrive at the upper end of the canyon. From up here, it's a spectacular deep gorge. I explore the canyon as much as I can, and as long as there is nothing to threaten my life. But as I walk the length of it, water from Tahtiaru Spring is nowhere to be found most of the way. The locals have already given me valuable information about that, but to see everything firsthand, I have to walk down to the bottom of the valley, and I do so with gusto and caution. One of the things that renders collagen even more remarkable is its pristineness. Not many nature travelers come here. Unfortunately, those who do don't leave behind any kind of waste or garbage. And that has turned this canyon into one of the most must-see natural sites in the Tabas area. There are canals here. In some places, water has pushed its way out, but there are still other canals inside walls that continue all the way to the villages of Tabas. And this water originates from the Tahta Aruz spring in Esmeran province. It's the same water that's come all the way here and has welled out. In the absence of plumbing in the past, they would channel fresh water from one village to another or from the mountains to their villages and farms by means of a canal system, and they did it to prevent the water from going to waste. This one here is one of those canals. Out on the bottom of the canyon, the water would sink into the ground. So they channeled the water downhill through a series of gently sloping tunnels along several kilometers to the places where it was needed for irrigation and domestic use. Although new canals are seldom built today, many old ones are still used in Iran, and have until recently served as one of the main reasons behind the continuation of life in areas with hot and dry climates. New technology has in recent years led to a rapid depletion of the underground water reservoirs, but we can still think of reviving the Qanat water supply system, take advantage of this millennia-old experience for agricultural purposes in Iran, and do something to make it happen. I knew very well that the rainfall in the eastern regions of the country is less than half the rain that falls in the western regions. Therefore, water is much more valuable in this part of the country. The people living in these parts have always been thinking of innovative ways of harnessing water and managing its resources. Digging canals and channeling underground water onto the surface was very common in Iran. They didn't cost much, and they were very efficient. Canals offered several advantages. Firstly, they prevent the sun from shining directly at the water and making it evaporate. Secondly, moving inside the mountains, not much of the water is absorbed by the bedding walls of the channel. And thirdly, the water is immune to any and all kinds of contamination and flows to its destination clean and cool. What's certain is that humans wouldn't have been able to survive in the desert areas if they hadn't built the canals. Almost all researchers believe that the world's first canals were built in areas under Iran's cultural influence. No one knows for sure why the ancient dwellers of this region named this gorge the Kala Jinni. But apparently, some of them believe this canyon was haunted by jinns or ghosts. There were others who believed the idea of digging holes and caves into the mountainside for safety was something that even ghosts wouldn't have been able to come up with. Or maybe the reason why this canyon was named the Canal of Jinns was the roaring seasonal floodwaters that swept along this canyon and still do today. Whatever the name, it must have been chosen for a reason. It defies belief that there is so much water in the Kala Jinni Canyon. To the people of southern Khorasan province, each drop of this water is worth as much as a kilo of saffron, and this canyon has a lot of it. It looks like someone has chiseled away at the rocks. The only sound you can hear in the mountains is that of the water rippling along the canals. Eventually, I get to a point in the canyon where the ancient dwellers of this land redirected the water from the surface to a canal inside the mountain. This is where the water is redirected underground. It was the brainchild of folks who lived here in the distant past. And that beautiful canal dug inside the wall of the canyon carries this water to the villages lying on the outskirts of Tabas. The locals have told me different things about the cavities and man-made holes inside the Kala Jinni. Apparently, No one has accurate information on the age of those cave-like shelters. But tales of how they came to be have been passed down from one generation to another. I spend hours scouring the canyon for those man-made tunnels, and I finally find them. It is hard to believe how these tunnels were hand-carved at this height. Niches that acted as footholds to help them climb some 5 or 6 meters to get to the chambers above, where they are likely to have lived. And that was where they felt safe. It's still not clear why these tunnels, these wells, and these chambers were dug into the walls of this canyon and at this height by the people in the past. But many believe they actually lived here. This was the perfect place for people to take shelter in and survive the stifling heat of the Tabas region. And there are many others who believe this was a place where the village dwellers around here, who wanted to steer clear of the brigands and looters, would transfer all their valuable belongings. They themselves would hide here too, along with their belongings, and wait for the looters to leave the area. Of course, there are also others who are of the opinion that these tunnels were just the right place for the people of that time to come to and worship their gods. That in fact, they considered this place as their place of worship. They call it the Canal of Djinns for a reason. It can get really scary in some parts. And it's obvious that torrential floodwaters have shaped this valley like this over the years. In fact, what those floodwaters did was wash away the dirt and stones on their path. Of course, it might have taken millions of years for this canyon to take on the shape it has today. It's frightening to be here and walking on the bottom flanked by tall walls. It looks endless to me. I've been walking these smaller gorges near Kalajini for hours, but it looks like there is no end in sight. I haven't been able to get to the other end of any of them. The deeper you go inside, you realize you have more to go. This is a completely virgin valley with no traces whatsoever of human activity in it. Usually, garbage is the first sign of human presence in the natural world. It's clear to me that only people who feel responsible to nature have been to this area before. That is because there is no trash on the ground and no writings on the walls. That has made my trip into the heart of the canyon ever more worthwhile and helped me appreciate its magnificence more intensely. My visit to the Kalajini Canyon has come to an end. I got to see beautiful sights in the canyon from different angles. The canyon has a scary name, but that didn't change my mind about traveling right into it and exploring it. I continue my trek in the desert, this time to see the desert flower, commonly known as the saffron crocus. That means an approximately 200-kilometer walking distance from the Kalajini Canyon. On my way there, the imposing ruins of an ancient building grab my attention. They are the remains of a desolate village by the name of Dihuk. Iranian deserts always have wonderful surprises for travelers, and this beautiful ancient village is one of them. What really tugs at my heartstrings, though, is that the villagers have abandoned these buildings with their unique architecture for brick-and-mortar homes. It saddens me to see traditional Iranian architecture consigned to oblivion by my fellow Iranians in cities and villages. Today, Iranian architecture that encompasses life and vitality, art and aesthetic beauties, and love and positive energy is being replaced by ghastly steel and mortar structures. Architecture that's alien to the Persian culture. Architecture that bears no signs of the ancient Persian culture and doesn't include the freshness, the gardens, the water pools, and other natural features characteristic of traditional Persian architecture. Such homes do not belong in our country, and I wish they'd never been built. In my opinion, this ancient village is one of the most beautiful villages I've ever seen in this area. The people here, I mean the people who used to live here, call this village Ancient Dihuk. Now, they live in a small township by the same name, built around 20 to 25 years ago. It was built after the earthquake in the year 1978. So now they call this place Old Dihuk, which, as I say, is one of the most beautiful villages on the margins of the Lut Desert.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
In the name of Allah, dear brothers and sisters, salam. So welcome to this program entitled Lantern. As you know, we have an interesting story at the beginning of the program. Today's story is organ donation. One of the richest and most powerful men in Brazil made waves when he announced plans to bury his $1 million Bentley so he could drive around the afterlife in style. He received lots of media attention and was criticized for the extravagant gesture. Why wouldn't he donate the car to charity? How out of touch with reality is this guy? He still went ahead with the ceremony, but there is a twist. Of course, there is. Why else would we be covering this story? To create awareness of organ donation. People condemn me because I wanted to bury $1 million Bentley. In fact, most people bury something a lot more valuable than my car, he said during a speech at the ceremony. They bury hearts, livers, lungs, eyes, kidneys. This is absurd. So many people waiting for a transplant, and you will bury your healthy organs that will save so many lives.
The process begins with an individual or their family agreeing to donate their organs. In most cases, organ donors are patients who've died in hospital, who've been declared brain dead, where all brain activity has definitely and irreversibly stopped. Their organs are then artificially maintained using a ventilator. Organs suitable for this type of donation are the lungs, heart, liver, kidneys, pancreas, intestines, and uterus. Doctors can also remove tissue from corneas, skin, heart valves, veins, arteries, tendons or bones. Bone marrow can also be transplanted, although it must come from a living donor. The time frame possible between tissue removal and transplantation is as little as 3 to 4 hours for a heart or 24 to 36 hours for a kidney. Transplant material is transported in airtight ice boxes, which must be kept below 4 degrees Celsius. The recipient is chosen according to their compatibility with the donor, regarding blood and tissue type, or a similar morphology or immune system. That's because the introduction of a foreign organ into the body causes the immune system to react as if under threat and attack it. To avoid rejection of the newly transplanted organ, doctors use medicine to suppress the recipient's immune system. Transplants are extremely delicate. The organ is reconnected to the circulatory system and slowly warmed to enable it to function again.
Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, wa bi nasta'in. One of the good and humanistic job that one may do is to dedicate, to sign a contract or a paper or a document that after his or her death, some parts of his body, his or her body, to be dedicated to a patient who needs those body organs. For example, when a person signs such an agreement or contract, in that after his or her death, for example, his heart or, for example, his liver, his or her liver, to be dedicated to a patient. This is a good job, and by doing so, he or she would save the life of someone else. As we know, there are many illnesses in which some people may need another body organ to be transplanted in them. For example, when someone, owing to an injury, someone cannot live in a normal way, but rather, with the help of some medical devices, he's alive, just alive, without any sense or sensation or without any reaction. If such a person had signed this contract or, this type of, document, that in such cases his body organs, which can be transplanted from his body organ to the body organ of someone else, to someone else who may need such a type of help or transplantation, this is a good job, because in this way the life of a patient who is about to die would save. His or her life would be saved. This is a good practice, because some people may think that while they have got some sick people among them about whose life there would be no more hope to be saved. In this case, we find that some medical doctors may suggest that, for example, a certain body organ should be transplanted in the body of the injured person, or in the body of the sick person.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
At the same time, we find that medical doctors usually, but not in most cases, but medical doctors usually try to do their best, as best as they can. At the same time, we find that some people may receive some money in return for doing this kind of transplantation, or for doing so. Now we find that there's no age limit. For example, the body organ of an adult person may be transplanted in the body of a sick, another sick person. At the same time, we find that there are medical limitations because of some genetic differences between people, or some blood group differences among people. Some people may not be able to receive such kind of transplantation. But all in all, doing this transplantation would save the life of another patient person. But at the same time, some people may say that after this transplantation, the body of the person from whom a body organ has been taken out may be deformed, but it isn't true. The point is that the body of this person would receive just some stitches in the place from where a certain body organ has been taken out.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you, to doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong, a world that often lies, as I don't need anyone.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.